And they made a very, very key change in language this last press conference. They talked about outlook, okay? Where they didn't do that during the inflation side. They didn't say, we're not gonna try to forecast inflation and make changes based on forecasts. Now they're saying it's the outlook of the labor market, co-opetition, I love it, as a completely unaccomplished racer myself. someone who has not won a thing but spent a lot of money.
Spent a lot of money on your losses, though.
So. Yeah, there's a lot of co-opetition.
Your job is to anticipate what's going to happen, not wait for it to happen and then act. I think that's what a lot of
people do. The best anticipators out there.
There you go. I love that. All right, welcome back to the Intelligent Investment Show with Garrett Lill and Matt Dahl of ARPG in Las Vegas. Welcome back, dude. Good to see you as always.
How's it going? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. We just finished up a tornado warning here, so we got a hurricane coming through, and I don't follow the news, right? So I don't ever find out a hurricane's here until it starts raining, and I look at my radar, and I'm like, how long is this going to last? I'm like, oh, 4 days. Cool. All right. So then like 5 minutes later, I got a tornado warning. It's like, you know, you look up exactly where it's at and what specific streets and all that, and it's like, literally, they're saying at the intersection of this and this, where the Costco and the Harris Teeter and the like, all that's walking distance from me. So I'm like, huh, okay. Apparently, I should have paid attention to this. So it's been a fun Friday morning already for me.
Well, I mean, you guys probably used to it by now. I mean, I think it was last year we had Hurricane Hillary. It went up through Arizona and it went like this around. It went around Vegas perfectly and then went straight up.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why that happened like that, but it did. And
it must have been a pretty ethically and morally sound hurricane. It didn't want any part of Sin City and Vegas. It just like, nah, we're taking the bypass.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it was a very pious hurricane. It didn't want anything to do with Vegas. So, but I got to tell you, I've never been in a hurricane, because, you know, being out here out west, and those clouds are big and they go forever.
Yeah,
and it's not like here where we get these spotty rain clouds and we know they're rain clouds and they're just rain clouds.
Right.
That's a different kind of a cloud. So, you know,
we're going to try to be really careful not to use any political names or anything in this, because every time I try to promote this show, if we, heaven forbid, accidentally mention the name of a person who's involved in a contest right now that is for the winner gets a position of power in this country, we get flagged and we can't actually send any promotional ads out. So we'll try to be even more guarded with our political views and thoughts and conversation than normal, if you can believe it, which is so ironic to me too, because if you've watched the show very much, there could not be two people who go further out of their way to not take a political side than you and I do, because we've both said many times we don't like either of them or any side. So we don't pick sides, but we still can't advertise because we mentioned certain words, I guess.
Well, it's funny is, the meeting with staff this morning, I reiterated to them, one of my advisors particularly, who keeps getting the same questions from clients, and I keep having to reiterate to him, which he's having to reiterate to his clients, is don't let politics infect, not affect, infect your investment decision making.
Yeah.
And I don't know what percentage of people do, but I'll bet you it's 95%+ of people are waiting to see what happens with the election before they do anything. And we can kind of see that actually in margin debt right now, right? Margin debt is actually, it's not in a bubble anywhere. Although the market's at all-time highs, margin debt, as we look at it through FINRA, is $740 billion. At the April lows, it was down to $710-720 billion. It wasn't that high.
It's been high end of that? What's the other end of that extreme?
Just under a trillion. So in 2021, fall of 2021, like October, November 2021, it got to $930 trillion. So we're well below that. But what's interesting this last month is we've seen margin debt go down, not up. Markets have come up, but margin debt has come down. And this, I think, has to do with people pulling back. They're not wanting to take on new margin debt while interest rates are coming down. They're going to wait till interest rates have bottomed before they take on margin debt so they can pay the lower rate for a longer period of time. But the other side of it, and probably the bigger side, again, I don't have any actual data on this, but you see this in election years, right? especially in an election like this. This is, again, every single election is the most important election of our lifetime. So, but this particular election, you're seeing such a wide disparity between the two sides that people are just kind of waiting to see what happens, and they're pulling back on debt. But the market's doing okay. You know, my guess is what is the equity markets are going to, they're going to buffet around, you know, in October like they always do ahead of an election, because, you know, people do unfortunately let their politics infect their investment decisions. And I think you will see a reaction out of the bond market specifically. You get more true quality decision making out of the bond side subsequent to the election than you will the equity side. The equity side is going to kind of move all over, but you're going to see the bond side really move in a more proper direction. My guess, you know, we talked about it, is I think there'll probably be a cooling of 10 basis points or so on the 10-year, a little bit if Harris wins. If the other side wins, you'll probably see an expansion of the 10-year yield of 20 basis points by the end of the year. My guess is you would probably have a pretty sizable spread there, you know, 70, 80 basis points. But we will never, there's no way to know that, because one of them will be in and one of them won't be in, so we won't know what the spread is, right? But my guess is there is going to be a bit of a...
The thing that's always so fascinating to me about that, and I know we've talked about this before on the show many shows ago, but the fact that a lot of investors wait, I mean, I remember hearing that in probably 2012, I'm guessing, maybe 2016, but I remember some of my clients that I had a ton of respect for. I mean, these are some of the most intelligent people that I knew in their field and what they did, highly successful and highly accomplished in what they did. And they would all say, I'm going to wait till after the election to make a decision on what I'm going to do. And there's a part of me that kind of understands where they're coming from. But at the same time, that's a lot like saying, I'm going to wait till the game is over to place my bet on who's going to win. Because by the time the results come in, everybody else already knows what you already know. And the puck has already landed where it was heading, and it's going to be adjusted accordingly. Now, certainly there can be some big moves, but they happen literally at the open on November, 6th this year? Because the election is the 5th. So literally at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time on November 6th, the market will fully digest in about a microsecond all of the election results from the night before, and whatever edge you thought you were getting from waiting is evaporated.
Yeah, Howard Marks says it great. He says, folks that wait, you know, they're not sure what to do. They want to wait till the election happens, or they want to wait till this earnings season's over. They want to wait till the dust settles. All those cliches. Well, when the dust has settled, all the money's been made.
Right.
That's why they call it investing, and that's why it's not called promising.
Yeah. This would be my catchy little one-liner. Don't wait, anticipate. Your job is to anticipate what's going to happen, not wait for it to happen and then act. I think that's what a lot of people do.
Yeah, it's our job to be the best anticipators out there.
There you go. I love that. No. Well, speaking of anticipating, we've talked a lot about the Fed and your expectations of rate cuts. And for a long time, you said you expected 2.5 rate cuts, which is literally impossible. But that's just basically saying 50-50 between two versus
right.
three.
Right.
Then we were talking yesterday about they kind of did what you didn't expect them to do. Maybe they did what they should do, or what you thought they should do, but you didn't really expect them to do what you thought they should do, so you were surprised by it almost.
Honestly, I was legitimately surprised with that rate decision. I didn't think they would want to surprise markets at all, which leads me to believe that they are acutely aware of the potential of the labor market to be a problem. And what they don't want to have happen is exactly what happened in 2021, where they called inflation transitory. They don't want to call a softening labor market, you know, it's softening and normalizing. And it is softening and normalizing. But again, if it starts to normalize too much, then there's a problem. And that's what happened before. I think they're getting ahead of it. August posted 114,000 new jobs on 180,000 consensus. But have the same consensus for September. Those were July jobs posted in August. And then we had the August jobs posted in September at 140,000 jobs on a consensus of 170,000. Okay, so it was closer, but we had massive revisions down of the prior months, right? So that's leading the Fed to believe that, okay, well, maybe this labor market, if we don't if we don't pay attention to it, it might get ahead of us. Then we might have to react to the labor market rather than keep the labor market in a healthy place, you know. And this is where we have really good Fed governors out there, really smart Fed governors who I think can see where the puck is heading to, and they're trying to get ahead of it, right?
Yeah.
Your Austin Goolsbees, your Jay Powells, your Mary Daly's, okay? These are smart. They're all very, very smart, okay? Even Waller, okay? But then you have the Michelle Bowmans, who dissented, was the first dissenting governor in 19 years. It was the first dissension in 19 years. And she actually was trying to promote rate increases as recently as April and May, saying we might need to raise again. And then she came out again saying after the dissension that she is not convinced that inflation is in the rearview mirror. And she is absolutely willing to continue to dissent. And if she would need to, she would actually want to raise rates, which says and this is my opinion, but the dual mandate lives, you manage it with what's going to happen. You don't manage that dual mandate with just what's happening today, because when it's inflation, it's data dependent. When inflation has effectively got to the place where you want it to be and the direction of it is where you want it to be, then it goes from data that you get, and again, trust your data, to, and they made a very, very key change in language this last press conference. They talked about outlook, okay, where they didn't do that during the inflation side. They didn't say, we're not going to try to forecast inflation and make changes based on forecasts. Now they're saying it's the outlook of the labor market. So they are going to try to forecast a weakening labor market, okay, and try to get ahead of it because, you know, again, they're very smart people at the Fed and they know fixing the labor market takes just as much time as it did to fix inflation, if not longer. But it's far more painful. I mean, people lose their jobs, you know, and it can have a massive dire effect, which can then cause it can just spiral out of control. So, and again, these people know what they're doing, and they have all of the data. They know how to interpret the data, and they know how to apply that data. So, I'm actually pretty confident in the Fed that they're going to get ahead of this. And my guess is we're probably going to get, you know, I've always held that 2 to 3. All year long, even in May, when it was down to people were saying none or maybe one, I said 2 to 3. We never changed it. If we get I don't want to say soft, okay, but below consensus, 10% below consensus, i.e. consensus is 175,000 jobs for September. If it prints below 155, I think we're going to get another 50 basis points in November or one in December. I think one of those two will be 50. My guess is it'll be 50, 50, 25 rather than 50, 25, 50. But I think we have an equal chance of getting 5 rate cuts as we do 4. So my guess would be 4.5. I'm going to change from 2.5 to 4.5.
From now until when?
End of the year.
End of the year.
So
put us somewhere around another 50 basis points from now to the end of the year total. You're thinking 75. Okay.
75.
So I'm looking right here at the technical. I mean, we've talked before about technicals and do they matter with bonds or do they matter at all? But, you know, we're sitting right at the level. The last time we were at 395 range, call it on the 10-year. Was almost exactly 2 years ago, September 22nd of 22, I believe, is where I was looking up there. So we're right at 2 years removed from the last time we were at this level. And then the technician would say, and again, I'm just saying this to play devil's advocate. I don't know if it matters at all if they would be right. But the technician would say, if we break through that, you know, what's the next support level? Well, the next support level is around 2% on a 10-year. That's because it escalated from 2% to 4% really quick in 2022. So does that line up? I don't bring that up to bring up the technical side as if that's what we're, you know, wanting to dwell on. But fundamentally, do the fundamentals support that a lot? Because a lot of times the fundamentals will support what you see in the technicals, and that can or cannot be relevant.
No, that gets us back to the football, right?
Yeah.
Something fundamentally has to change to move to that new area of technicals. So the new area, my guess is I think we're going to finish 325-ish by the end of the year, 350, 325 would be my guess. And that's going to be based on probably a good labor market, but softening labor market, and GDP. So GDP last quarter, the final revision came out yesterday for Q2. Q2 GDP year over year, 3% in Q2. So we had 3% GDP growth in Q2. Again, up from 1.4 in Q1. So the Atlanta Fed tracker for Q3, right, just came out today, was updated today from 2.9 to 3.1. These are good numbers. I love these numbers. We're not too hot. We're not too cold. And the 10-year is going to live in that range. It's not going to be more than 50, 60 basis points outside of that range. So that's where I think the 10-year is going to come in, into that 350 to 325 range by the end of the year, because I think we'll kind of stick around that 3% GDP growth, right? And I think the 10-year is going to kind of pull back a little bit as PCE came in this morning, nice and cold. Somebody said it great this morning. I can't remember which analyst said it, but they said all quiet on the inflation front. We had basically 0.1% PCE month over month on headline. We're at 2.2 on headline, 2.7 on core. We had 0.17 on core. These are the numbers that they're looking for. I don't expect a big dip in core PCE year over year by the end of the year, simply because of the year over year numbers that are coming up that are going to drop off from last year aren't all that hot. However, the beginning of 2025, we had some warm inflation numbers at the beginning of 2024. Those numbers are going to drop off, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where we're going to start to see that core PCE year over year number really start to cool down. And I think the bond market is going to get ahead of that, specifically that shorter end of the curve, that 2-3-5 year will really start to come down. And I think that'll be really good for mortgage rates as well, right? Because those shorter end of the curve rates come down, those regional banks are going to, obviously they're going to buy their money for quite a bit less. And we're going to get that spread, that 10-year yield to mortgage, 30-year mortgage spread back to that, close to that average of 1.65%.
And I don't mean to get bogged down so much on interest rates. I feel like I've kind of dug my heels in here. I want to talk about this too much, but the 10-year is what gets the headline most of the time. I mean, that's what that's what the Barclays Ag is based off of. That's the one that you seem to see quoted most. It's sort of the S&P 500 of the bond market. But right now, how much are you looking at, or how much weight are you putting on the 10-year movement versus like the 2-year movement, like you were just talking about the short in there? Because what's also happened here is 10 years have come down, 2 years have come down just a little bit faster, so that we're no longer in that inverted state that we were in, 6 months ago. It's close. It's like 25 bips off, but it's not inverted anymore. So half of the inverted equation is the 2-year. So do you think we spend too much time on the 10 and not enough on the 2, or maybe
the 2-year is closer to is more of your price action, right? And 2-year, right. 2-year has a lot more to do with inflation and very near term economic strength or weakness. Whereas your 10-year is more of your longer term general neutral rate. Okay. And you'll find, I'll bet, the R star, the neutral rate, and the 10-year are probably going to be really, really close. Okay. So the 10-year and the policy rate, I don't expect to be all that different. That's why the 10-year is so widely utilized. It's not too long in duration. It's not too short in duration. People tend to stay in their homes an average of close to 10 years. So that's kind of why that's why they use that in comparison to the mortgage rates. Okay. But the 2-year is very sensitive to short-term economics, inflation, those types of things. And what you and I have talked about several times through many shows is that shorter end of the curve has to come down, and that is dead linked to inflation. It's absolutely pinned to inflation. And in order for a lot of wealth unlock to take place, i.e. in the real estate market, the shorter end of the curve has to come down. Although mortgage rates are more correlated toward 10 years, we need to see that 2-year come down, because it's the banks that they borrow with a secured overnight financing rate, which is those shorter end of the curve, and then they lend out at the longer term rate. So in order for mortgage rates to come down, the 10-year doesn't really need to come down. That shorter end needs to come down, because I think right now the mortgage rates, as far as the rate of change, is going to correlate more so with that shorter end, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we can see that obviously banks, when they lend, the 30-year fixed mortgage in December of 2021 was 3.27%. Okay. And this was about a month ago. They're lending it, they were lending at 7.14, right? Whereas we had the 10-year at, we had the Fed funds rate at 0.25. Now we have it at 5.5 at that time, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're at 5%, or 5% on the upper bound, and 6.2%. Okay, so 5%. So you can see how much less money the bank is making when they're borrowing it at 5, right, and lending it at 6.2, versus when they were borrowing it at 0.25 and lending it at 3.27, right? So that spread is so much tighter now. So that's why rates are higher, right? So in order for mortgage rates to really, really come down, banks have to get that spread back.
Yeah. So rotating that into the other conversation in our I love our pre-production calls. It's literally just like a 20-minute phone call where we spend like 5 minutes talking about the show. But you talked about we're at all-time highs and we just keep racing higher and higher and higher, but that's not distributed evenly among all sectors. There are some sectors that are racing higher and others that are struggling and others that are falling behind. So kind of take me through that again, what you said yesterday. I thought was a good point.
Well, we've seen the tech sector rally, right, a lot. And the market's up a little bit, but not all that much. Like it's at 57, whatever it is,
57.50, something like that.
Yeah, we were at 57.15 2 weeks ago, right?
Right.
And when we talked, you know, it's been kind of bouncing around, but the tech sector has made a huge comeback. And Nasdaq's made a pretty good comeback. Chips, the SOX has made a good comeback. All those have made a great comeback. But what's been kind of keeping the market backwards a little bit, or what's kind of keeping it from just running 5,800, 5,850, 5,900, and just kind of going berserko, is healthcare and financials. So healthcare and financials together make up almost the same size of the market as tech by itself. Tech is 28% of the market. Tech and financials are about 25% of the market combined. Okay, healthcare being the bigger of the two. Healthcare, again, I hate this, but election season. Healthcare is a very politicized sector. Okay, mm-hmm. Medical insurance, of course, drug prices. They're all over the insulin, and now they're picking on the new one, which is these weight loss drugs. You know, Bernie Sanders talking about the way, you know, Ozempic and Wegovy, these people need to have access to these drugs, but the billionaire drug companies won't let them, you know, have them, whatever he says. He's just that guy.
I just had a total change of direction here. I don't think we should stop going political. I think we should go 100% political and say the heck with it and just let you do like a Saturday Night Live impression skit, because you have some incredible impersonations of our political leaders.
I'm terrible. In fact,
although I couldn't tell if that was Bernie Sanders or Christopher Walken, to be honest with you. Oh, it was a really good Christopher Walken, too.
Yeah. One of my advisors said, your impressions are terrible. Stop doing them. I'm like, first of all, my impressions are good, and you can just go flag back.
I like your impressions.
But it's a highly politicized sector, right? And when you get healthcare, you get all the drug companies and you get all the drug insurers, all the healthcare insurers and managed cares, right? The Cigna is the United Health on the one end, and you get the Mercks and the Pfizers and the Eli Lilly's on the other end, right? And everybody loves to pick on the drug companies and to pick on the insurance and all the health managed care companies, you know. So I don't expect them to go very far until next year. Okay.
Yeah.
So financials, horse of a little different color.
They're fighting a fight, but it's with a different opponent because they're fighting with the Fed and interest rates. That's what's really driving the.
Well, what healthcare is doing right now is they're waiting for election season to be over, so that they can stop being picked on, and people will go by there. And again, like we said before, we don't know what the number is, but we know a lot of people let politics infect their investment decisions. So I'm sure that's part of it, right? I'm sure that's what's happening in healthcare right now. That being said, financials rallied. Rallied from August 5th all the way through, guess what day? September 18th, the day after the Fed decision. Actually, the 19th, the day after the Fed decision. So we had a huge buy the rumor and sell the news. But what kicked it off? What kicked off the financials? That's when rates came down. Treasuries got bought when August posted that ugly jobs number. I'm sorry, it was a July jobs number posted in August, where we posted 114,000 jobs on 180,000 consensus. That was that Friday. That very next Monday was that yen carry trade crash. Mm-hmm. Okay, and of course, everyone ran to safety. They bought treasuries, yields came down, financials ripped. Okay, just ripped. I think that had to do with people kind of run. I think it was more the jobs market that started it off, and that yen carry trade kind of just supercharged it in the very short term around that August 5th date. And then basically what happened is the bond market then bought the rumor. They bought the Fed rate cut well ahead of it. And no one really knew what to do, right? Are they going to cut 25? Are they going to cut 50? This is the one of those times when no one really knew. You and I said, I think they should cut in July. I don't think they're going to, but they should. They didn't, but they should have. Then we said, I think they should cut 50, but I don't think they're going to, but I think they should. And they did. Okay. So literally right before the Fed decision came out that morning, September 17th, the average cut was 0.41. It wasn't dead in the middle. It was leaning toward 50. Okay. It was leaning that way. So once that happened, effectively all of the bond purchasing had been done to get ahead of that event. And then there was kind of a sell the news. And well, to be fair, we've had some pretty strong economic data. We've had decent PCE. PCE didn't fall off a cliff. We had the weekly jobless claims lowest in several months. And we had a GDP tracker came out this morning, adjusted up to 3.1. So we've had some good economic data. We have, frankly, a pretty strong economy. So it's hard. It's going to be really hard for those yields to fall off a cliff in light of what's taking place.
Yeah. So the other thing we talked about yesterday is the dependence or the connection, I suppose, maybe the connection is probably a better word there, the connection between the U.S. economy and the China economy or the Chinese economy. You know, it's interesting to me in the globalized economy that we're in right now and just the world we live in, everything is so interconnected. There's competition to an extent. There's a term I've heard this used in auto racing, actually coopetition, right? Where it's like you're not really necessarily working against each other, but you're not working together either necessarily. And to some extent that plays to the economic landscape. I mean, we don't need, yes, we want to do better than China, but we don't want to just, we don't want China to go away and just bury them because we're very dependent on them as well. And to some extent, we need them to have a good economy. We are relying on them to have a good economy. We don't want to be the only country in the world with a good economy because then we won't have any trade partners and there's ripple effects and all that kind of stuff. So we were talking yesterday about kind of the balancing act of that, right? Because yeah, we are, there's this, I don't know, rivalry almost that Americans have with China, but at the same time, make no mistake about it, we definitely want them to have a good economy and we do benefit from that in certain ways.
Coopetition, I love it. That's cool.
Darrell Waltrip, the old NASCAR driver, that's where that comes from. I think he coined that, coopetition.
You know, that's funny because, you know, as a completely unaccomplished racer myself, someone who has not won a thing but spent a lot of money.
Spent a lot of money on your losses, though.
So. Yeah, there's a lot of coopetition, which for me is asking for help from other people who have won, and they give me little nuggets of knowledge, and I go out and do something completely else. Different than what they tell me to do, and then it doesn't work, and then somehow it's not my fault. You know what I mean? So, but that's how it works. Is in the pits, we were just at the U.S. Nationals in Indianapolis, right? It's the biggest race. We raced an NHRA a class called Competition Eliminator, and we were pitted with all the other Competition Eliminator competitors, and anyone in those pits would give you anything they have, tools, parts. Wouldn't take a dime for it. Mm-hmm. That's how it is. It's a real good group of people, right? And they want to make sure that you can get to the track and you're there to race, and they want you to race.
Yeah.
But make no mistake about it. When you cross through that water, and you start your burnout, and that tree comes down, they are your worst enemy.
Yeah. Right? And they want to make sure you can race, because if you can't race, they don't have anybody to beat. Right. That's basically what it comes down to.
And as soon as you cross through that line and those parachutes come out, they're your best friend again.
Yeah.
But that's – and I'm not – I don't think that is a perfect analogy for the U.S.-China. I don't think it's that friendly. Don't get me wrong. It's not that friendly. However, having China be a strong economy should give the world comfort. Mm-hmm. Okay. Having a strengthening China is inflecting from three bad years. They're really stepping up with their stimulus to do it. They're the second largest economy in the world. They're 8-9% of global GDP. They are a massive, massive, massive consumer of materials. Materials just now this week broke out of a three-year base. Just now, materials are breaking out because of China. Okay, the material sector, you know, is getting ahead of what's going to happen in China. China, the PBOC governor, Gong Sheng, he lowered bank reserve rates significantly. Okay, he lowered their benchmark 7-day rate from 1.7 to 1.5 on their 7-day rate. And he acknowledged that further easing is in the pipeline before the end of this year. He also said they're going to cut the interest rates payable on existing mortgages. So if you're paying a mortgage right now and you're paying whatever, call it 6%, they're lowering those just across the board because they can. And they're lowering the down payment requirements for new homes. They're really trying hard to get their, because they're a big real estate economy. They're a big commodity economy. They're a big materials economy. They're a big industrial economy. Okay. We're starting to see those sectors really do well. Equal weight industrial at an all-time high relative to the S&P right now. And I attribute this to China because the materials sector, how do you get the materials? You need Caterpillar tractors. You need John Deere tractors. You need those things. That's right. How you get them out. So having a good, strong China is good for everyone. I mean, they have a very strong consumer base. I mean, you have basically 300 plus million Chinese people living the same way Americans do. Now, don't get me wrong. There's another 1.1 or 1.2 billion not living like we do, Americans. But that's still a very strong, strong, powerful economic cohort, right? So we need them to be strong. They're strong consumers. They come to the United States. They come to Las Vegas all the time, and we see them at the casinos, right?
Yeah.
And they spend money here, and they have a grand old time. Okay.
Yeah.
We need them to come here and spend money, just like they need us to go to Macau and spend money over there. In fact, if you look at Las Vegas Sands, they don't have any properties in Las Vegas anymore. The Venetian, the Plaza, they're owned by somebody else. They were sold off. All of the Las Vegas Sands now is Macau properties. Wynn Resorts, 70% of the revenue generated on Wynn Resorts is from the Macau properties, not the Las Vegas properties. Okay, so China is a very, 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 very powerful consumer economy. It's not just an industrial manufacturing base. It's strong consumerism over there too. So we need them to, you know, want to buy Harley Davidsons, want to go gambling, want to buy a Starbucks, want to go buy Nikes. We need that. And my guess is, I had this in the portfolio last year and I got out of it. That was a good trade to get out of our portfolios. But I'm thinking about putting it back in because everybody hates it. Is Nike. Nike is very correlated to China. Very correlated to China. So, and I said, with China inflecting like this, the Chinese consumer inflecting like this, that could be a good position to take.
This is an unscripted, unexpected question, but do you think, is there an outcome to the election that creates a friendlier environment for China? And what I'm talking about there is not necessarily, even though they're probably the same, I would imagine, not necessarily foreign relations with China. And are we going to be more, is there a president or a potential candidate who, due to expected policy, would be able to move the needle one direction or the other in the Chinese economy based on cooperating with them versus fighting with them? I mean, if we have an attack on China and throwing tariffs and all these different things against them, okay, well, that's good for us, bad for them. It kind of nets out. But is there a candidate, one candidate or the other, that is, for whatever reason, would create a more favorable environment for the Chinese economy without the expense of us? Or is that too loaded of a question to even try to go there?
No, I mean, that's a great question. I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, obviously, if the Democrat got in, Harris got in, that would be far more beneficial to the Chinese economy than if, you know, Trump got back in. Mm-hmm. Trump obviously wants to put tariffs on Chinese imports. In fact, he was at the John Deere factory speaking to the John Deere people with the John Deere CEO standing right next to him on Monday. And said, if he exports your guys' jobs to Mexico, I'm putting a 200% tariff on these tractors. He did that at the John Deere factory.
He doesn't care who's standing there.
No. And they're like, holy, what? You know? So, and that's Mexico. Okay. I mean, if he does that, you know, if he starts getting, you know, starts picking on China, you know, what, a 500% tariff? Who knows? It could be anything. So, you know, Harris has not been that, she's not been so pro-tariff.
Yeah.
As far as imports are concerned, what be it Mexico or China. Yeah. So I don't expect there to be any new material tariffs that are implemented under a Harris presidency. And I would expect there to be tariffs or the threat of tariffs, but those threats will be made good on. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's true. Good on
okay. If Trump gets in. So I think the Chinese economy will become a bit volatile. I think when you want to talk about like the China large cap ETF, like the FXI, will get pretty choppy if he gets in, because it'll be a lot of fits and starts. You know, there'll be a lot of, hey, this is happening. There'll be, you know, obviously there'll be the never ending Taiwan saber rattling, right? That just seems to go on and on. Yeah. And that will then be answered with tariffs and amongst other probably more boisterous military-based things, which could cause issues in the Chinese markets and Chinese economy. Yeah. But it also could be pro-China, too, because what they'll do is they'll say, okay, and they'll sell more of their stuff to other parts of the world, and they'll obviously want to buttress their defense sector, too, if that takes place. So kind of short answer, easy answer, and I know it's an easy answer, would be, yeah, if the Democrat gets in, that would be obviously better for China than if the Republican got in. Yeah. It would appear based on what the communications that we've seen come out of the two camps.
Well, Matt, always a pleasure as always. If you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else we are, the Intelligent Investment Show is absolutely 100% not intended as investment advice or financial advice of any kind, because neither Matt nor I know anything about your financial situation. However, I'm sure Matt and his team would be more than happy to get to know your financial situation if you would like to speak to a professional. Matt and his team can be reached at 702-655-8300 or at intelligentinvestment.com. You can also go to wealthpartners.io, and there's a link in the description here to the homepage here for the show, and there's a contact form you can reach out to me or Matt through that. But Matt and his team would love to chat with you, but do not take anything that we say on this show as anything more than just us running our mouth for the, honestly, just pure entertainment of it, I guess.
Right.
Well, Matt, you have a great weekend, brother. Always a pleasure. See you in a couple of weeks. And thanks as always, dude.